From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KCUR in Kansas City.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump is expected to declare the opioid crisis a national public health emergency today. That could give states more flexibility in how they spend federal money to respond to rising addiction and overdose rates. Last year, more than 64,000 people died of opioid-related overdoses. James Lutowski has treated some of those people. He's a crew chief paramedic for the Pittsburgh Bureau of Emergency Medical Services, and he joins us. James, first of all, how often do you have to respond to overdose calls these days?
Probably at least daily. We see a lot more today than we ever have.
I mean, how much has that changed from the past?
We were just talking about it in October of 14. We had seen like 70 overdoses total. In 15, it was up into the 90s, low 100s. And in 16, it was over 200.
Wow. So a pretty significant increase
there. Oh, yeah.
And now it's a daily occurrence. I mean, what are the calls like?
It depends. A lot of them are in rather untoward environments. There's usually a lot of people around, obviously a life-threatening emergency, so there's a lot of hectic care and response involved.
Now, I'm curious, I mean, is there a particular call or particular person who you've treated that stands out to you?
I would say probably the one that really sticks in my mind the most was we went on a call at like a local hotel where these three children had kind of been left alone and the mom was overdosed in a different location and we got sent to pick up the children. So I wasn't really treating the overdose but more of the people that were affected by the addiction. And when we went to collect her kids, they were soiled and soaked and hungry and hadn't eaten in a couple of days. And we picked up, you know, the baby, and she was only maybe 18 months old. And when we tried to put her in the car seat, she had latched on to us and was screaming and crying. And it was just so heartbreaking because she didn't want to put down, probably because she hadn't been seen in days. And it's just like when you look around and see the level of effects that the overdoses have on everybody around them, not just the person, not just the providers, but their families and even people that don't know them, it's just incredible.
Do you know what happened to that family?
The children had to go to foster home for a time while the mother tried to go into rehab, but that was the last that we heard.
I wonder, do you see people more than once?
Sometimes we see people more than once in the same day.
In the same day?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
There's like this vicious loop where there's not a lot of vectors to deliver patients to treatment centers directly from the field. So either the person will refuse transport to the hospital or the person went to the emergency room and they get frustrated because of the time it takes to try to get them treatment options. They'll leave the emergency room against medical advice and then just be back with the same people in the same environment within just a couple of hours and then re-overdose.
Wow. Now, you're saving a lot of people day in and day out, but I imagine that there are those that you can't save. We've been hearing about places where the problem is so bad and the challenges are so great that even, you know, the morgues are filling up. Is that a problem in Pittsburgh?
We see a lot more people who are deceased than we previously did. And it's harder because they're younger. A lot of the people that have passed away and there's nothing that we can do for them. Just coming in contact with a 20-year-old who had their whole life ahead of them, and now they're dead and there's nothing you can do, like that is a significant increase than we had seen prior to the epidemic.
Mm. You know, I really appreciate the professionalism and care with which you obviously go about doing your job every day, but I got to ask, I mean, does it take a toll on you?
It's very frustrating because I've even taken care of people that I have went to high school with, and we were all on the same track. We played sports and, you know, we were both going to different colleges and we were doing the same thing. And then just somewhere along the route, you know, someone that I went to high school with and grew up with will be a heroin addict. And when you see someone who is affected and they're only 16 or 18 years old, or you see someone who's elderly that's affected and are addicted to heroin now, which used to be unheard of. So today, any call we go on from a car accident to a person who fell could actually end up being an overdose that has just taken place.
Hmm. Well, as you know, the president is announcing a public health emergency about the opioid crisis today. I'm just curious, if you had a chance to speak with President Trump, I mean, what would you tell him? What would you need to hear, or what would you like him to know?
The most important thing is that we can't forget the humanity of it. Overdoses affect every single person, and even though that person makes really bad choices, they are still people, and it's a medical condition, and they need help. And the second most important thing I would say is to try to funnel money towards high-impact programs, things that can really do boots-on-the-ground work and help people get into treatment facilities. And I think it's really important to focus on prevention and then for the people who are already addicted, focus on treatment options to help reverse the addiction.
Well, James Lutowski is a crew chief paramedic with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Emergency Medical Services. Mr. Lutowski, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to do it.
Well, given the extent of the opioid crisis, some medical providers are taking the lead and looking for alternative, non-addictive painkillers. John Daly from Colorado Public Radio has that story.
All right. Last thing. What are we doing for you? Just confirming.
Taking out three wisdom teeth.
Which at a dental center in Lafayette, Colorado, oral surgeon Kurt Hayes gets started.
We're taking out number 1, 16, and 17.
Flora Brewington is getting three wisdom teeth removed. The surgery involves wrenching teeth out with pliers, so it results in some post-operative pain. For years, dentists have prescribed pain-killing opioids like Percocet or Vicodin. But Dr. Hayes recently switched to an alternative.
So this is the beginning of the Exparel.
He injects the FDA-approved local anesthetic Exparel into his patient's gums. That area will stay numb, pain-free for 2 to 3 days. And it's not an opioid. Hayes says he can now generally remove wisdom teeth without using any narcotics for pain, so there's no need to prescribe his patient a dozen or more pills.
Now I've backed off to where I don't give any narcotics whatsoever, and I have people just using ibuprofen and then over-the-counter Tylenol, and that's acceptable, and it takes care of the pain.
Hayes followed the development of Exparel in journals. He read about doctors using it for C-sections. He started using it mainly for patients who had abused narcotics in the past. After seeing positive results, Hayes started using it for all his patients.
We need to be looking at every aspect of the opioid crisis, whether it's the exposures, whether it's the number of narcotics that are being prescribed per case.
And it is a crisis. 33,000 people died from an opioid overdose in the U.S. in 2015. Opioid use often leads to an addiction to heroin, which claimed nearly 13,000 lives that same year. In Colorado, overdoses from opioids and heroin taken together now rival deaths from diabetes, car accidents, and chronic liver disease.
Opioids ought to be drugs of last resort, not drugs of first choice.
That's Robert Valick. He heads a Colorado consortium for drug abuse prevention. Valick says medicine cabinets containing leftover pills are often the gateway to an opioid addiction. One strategy to combat that is to reduce the number of pills doctors prescribe in the first place.
Hold off on the opioid. Try the other stuff first. See how far I can get you without them. And then if I need them, they're there in my back pocket.
Colorado's Dental Board is developing new best practices for pain management, and the Colorado Dental Association is holding educational seminars. Dr. Brett Kessler is a dentist in Denver and past president of the state association. He says across the board, medical providers are reexamining their role in the opioid crisis.
It's on every healthcare practitioner's mind. Looking for alternatives to manage the pain is huge. It's a growing trend nationally.
Kessler notes many teens and young adults get their first exposure to the narcotics when they get wisdom teeth removed.
There's studies out there that show if you give more than a 3-day dose of opiates, they've got a much higher chance of becoming addicted later in life.
I was like, don't give me many opioids or none, or what are my pain
options? Patient Paula Ryan was in Dr. Hayes' office recently for a tooth extraction. They discussed her pain management options, and she chose the alternative, Exparel. She remembers having another dental surgery years ago. Then she was prescribed opioids for pain and was pretty out of it for a few days. She prefers the alternative.
But I was wide awake and I could do whatever I needed to do, and I was there for my daughter. So you know, it was a much better outcome. I would definitely choose this route again.
Exparel costs between $250 and $400 per dose, and Dr. Hayes says it's not covered by insurance. But that potential cost didn't keep patient Flora Brewington from choosing it. She's an MD practicing family medicine and opted for the non-opioid method to manage her post-operative pain.
I think so. Yeah, I can't think of a disadvantage other than having to, you know, pay out of pocket for it at this point.
Plus, Brewington says she'd rather not have any extra pills forgotten in some medicine cabinet just waiting to be discovered.
I have two little kids at home, so it's best not to have narcotics sitting around. And
experts say it's that kind of awareness from both medical patients and providers that'll be crucial to turning the corner on the opioid crisis. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly in Denver.
We're broadcasting today from Kansas City, Missouri, a state that was once a political bellwether. For a century, Missouri was considered the ultimate swing state. Its voters backed every presidential winner but one from 1904 to 2004. In the last 40 years, it's had four Republican governors and five Democratic ones. And the state legislature shared a similar split in power. But in recent years, political scientists who once saw this purple state as a microcosm of the country have started to notice a change.
I would say light pink.
Beth Fanami is a political scientist at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
The way Missouri is set up geographically, where you have a large swaths of Missouri that are very deep red, I would say, and then pockets of Missouri that are very blue. And so I think that sort of together makes it pretty light pink.
Light pink, she says, and growing redder by the year.
I mean, part of it is that Missouri is kind of the quintessential rural-urban divide. So there's the only urban pockets in the state are along I-70, as you guys might drive.
Kansas City and St. Louis.
Yeah, and then in between with Columbia, with the University of Missouri. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the state is really rural. And so you have very conservative areas of the state. Then you have, you know, your typical suburban, which could go either way. And then you have the blue.
Vanami says the reason Missouri was so good at predicting the next president was that it looked a lot like the rest of the country. And that history goes back to the Civil War, when Missouri was literally a battleground state made up of both Union and Confederate sympathizers. By the turn of the century, Missouri, like the country as a whole, was starting to boom. It was home to the largest railroad hub in the U.S. It had grown into the fifth largest state, and St. Louis had become the fourth largest city. Anyone who wanted to become president needed to win those votes.
Very quickly, John McCain is one of the show me state. Missouri painted it red.
We now have
2008 was the year Missouri cast its vote for John McCain, who won the state by just 4,000 votes. He didn't, however, win the White House. And since then, Missouri's gone to the Republican candidate every time. What changed? Demographics, for one thing.
That's true. Yeah, Missouri is definitely, demographically, it's less similar to other areas of the country, certainly the Southwest and the South, which tends to be much more diverse. So that, you know, certainly makes it more likely to lean Republican.
And it's older.
Yeah.
Missouri is 20% whiter than the country as a whole. Latinos make up just 4% of the state's population, compared with 18% nationally. And as its population has remained stagnant, residents are growing older and more reliably Republican. One person who knows the state's voters very well is Democrat Jason Kander. He's the former Secretary of State for Missouri. Last year, he ended up just a few points short of unseating Missouri's incumbent Republican Senator Roy Blunt.
Everybody really, I think, recognizes that there was a bit of a wave last year. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, I got over 220,000 votes from folks who also voted for President Trump. I did that running as a progressive. So I think it's pretty clear that when you have candidates that are fighting for what they believe in, you have a chance to win. Also, it's important to remember that the cycle before that, when I ran in 2012, President Obama lost the state that day by almost 10, and I won on the same day. So I think it's clearly a state where it's always up for grabs.
So what do you think that you know about winning in Missouri that some of these other candidates don't, other Democrats?
I've been in 28 states so far this year, you know, to speak to Democratic groups. And it's no different, Missouri or any other red or purple state. and that when we go out and we make our argument, we have a chance to win. You don't win arguments that you don't make. And the thing is that voters will forgive you for holding a position that they don't also hold, as long as they know that you truly believe what you're saying, and this is important, and that you believe it because you care about them, because you think it'll make a difference in their lives. And when that's the case, folks will consider you.
How much time did you spend as a candidate in the rural parts of Missouri where probably most people are not going to vote for a Democrat?
Well, I went to every single county, so 114 counties plus the city of St. Louis, and I really think that that's important. Like, part of being a Democrat is I believe that what we want to do is better for every single American. I don't think that, like, there are some Americans who come out ahead with our approach and some who don't. I think whether you're rich or poor, black or white, man, woman, gay, straight, whether from the city or the country, I think what we want to do is going to make the most difference in your life. Well, if you believe that, then how do you write off any voters? You can't. You shouldn't. So that's always been my approach. It's not just about having the courage to make your argument. It's about making it to absolutely everyone.
You think a lot of Democrats have been writing off a lot of voters?
Yeah, I think if you look around the country, there have been a lot of cases where folks have just kind of said, well, you know, maybe that's not our voter. Maybe they're not amenable to what we have to say. And again, you lose arguments that you don't make. We know that. And so I think it's, you know, and a lot of people have tried to make this about, do you go after this group of people or that group of people? My point is, I believe in what we have to say. I believe it's the best thing for everybody. So we ought to go after everybody, right? I think that's how it is. And it's not about – I certainly don't think we should change what we stand for, depending on who we're talking to. I just think we ought to make our argument to everybody.
Although I would imagine that some Democrats would say we have, you know, limited amount of resources. Sure. Why should we go to places where we're not going to win that many votes?
Sure. Well, what I'm saying is you got to make your argument everywhere. It don't cost much to go to a place and talk to folks.
Hillary Clinton didn't make much of an argument in Missouri in the last election. She had only a few events here. Kander lost his Senate race by 3 points, while Hillary Clinton lost Missouri by almost 20. Why do you think Missouri voters were so into President Trump in the last election?
A lot of people looked at President Trump and said, okay, here's a guy who they don't like him. They'll say, I don't like the guy. I don't like the way he treats people. But they would say, but, you know, if he has made himself successful being, you know, acting that way, now we can dispute all that. But, you know, people said, okay, if that's made him successful and he's willing to do that for the country, then it's not like people are saying, oh, that's great. They were saying, I'm willing to give that a try, a lot of them were. Well, what's happened now is he's not made the transition from doing that for himself to doing that for the country. And that is why you're seeing people really sour on him in a lot of ways.
Are you seeing people sour on him?
Absolutely. I'm seeing people come up to me and they're like, I voted for both of you and I wish I hadn't voted for him.
We have to win Missouri. That's what I have to win. If we don't win Missouri, I'll be very angry.
The excitement you hear at that campaign rally in St. Louis translated at the ballot box. But what about now? At a voter forum in Lee's Summit, Missouri, we met Janice DeVinny, an office manager who says she's an independent voter and she's not happy with President Trump.
I'm not impressed. I think it's all about his ego and not about the people. It's all about his pocketbook and not about the people.
Mark Bredemeyer, a local attorney, disagrees.
Personality-wise, I do things a lot different. But I think as a Republican and as a conservative, I think he's been very, very committed to and consistent with Republican and conservative principles.
And he thinks there's something about President Trump that speaks to Missouri voters.
I think Missouri, again, having been a swing state and a somewhat of a presidential bellwether state through most of the last century, really. And what ended up happening there is you had the most unconventional candidate that you've seen that came out and came across as very genuine and very real.
Travis Smith says that feeling of authenticity is important in Missouri. He's with Axiom Strategies, one of the largest Republican consulting firms in the country based here in Kansas City.
The state on the whole, I don't know that I would say it is getting more conservative. There's always a certain contingent of the base that would describe themselves as both economic and social conservatives. I don't know that I would think that that contingent is growing, but there is a, whether you want to call it a populist sort of a piece of the electorate here, and that piece is obviously growing, goes without saying. And Republicans have done a good job at capturing that part of the electorate in recent cycles.
One of the last Democrats in statewide office in Missouri is Senator Claire McCaskill, who's facing a tough reelection campaign next year. She's already won two Senate races in Missouri.
And they all said, it's over. It's done. It's too red. It's just too red. There is no way that Claire McCaskill can survive. Well, you know what happened? You proved them wrong.
How do you explain that, Claire McCaskill? Why does she do well where other Democrats don't?
She's a savvy politician. And, you know, there is something similar between her style. Don't take this to the extreme, but there's something similar to her style, her manner, the way she speaks to her voters, and the way, frankly, that we saw Donald Trump speak. She's able to come across as kind of a real individual. Now, all that being said, I don't agree with virtually anything that Claire does, says, or stands for. But, you know, I think that on a smaller scale, there is some of that kind of plain-spokenness that voters like from her.
She's authentic.
Authentic, yeah.
But it's unclear if that authenticity will continue to keep McCaskill in her Senate seat. If she loses, that would paint this once purple state another shade of red, says political scientist Beth Vanami. Where do you think Missouri is going politically in the next 10 years?
I suspect it's going to continue sort of in the slight pink to red range. I don't see it likely to turn around unless something really dramatic happens at the national level. I don't see it moving back into the purple, light blue column anytime soon.
Twitter is on the verge of a breakthrough. It could soon be profitable. The company's third quarter earnings showed revenues of $590 million and a net loss of just $21 million. CEO Jack Dorsey and his team project that they could be profitable next quarter, which would be a big milestone for the tech company. Twitter's user numbers were also up this quarter, but they admitted that they had misreported previous user numbers. Emily Glazer is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and she joins us. And Emily, some of this is great news for Twitter, but tell us more about those user numbers, because that news seems significant.
This is tricky, and it was really interesting because even though their shares jumped around 14% before the market opened, and they've lost a little bit since then, so generally the market's excited by this news, but they had to readjust their monthly users back to the fourth quarter of 2014 because the company counted users of a third-party app service as its own. So it actually had to change its user figures for the past three quarters, and that always makes people nervous. Restating anything is never a good thing.
Yeah, and how much was the restatement? I mean, how much did they have to change the numbers by?
It was no more than 1 to 2 million extra users each quarter. And just to put that in perspective, the latest user figure is 330 million users. So it's a small fraction, but you lose some of the trust of the investors and the public when you have to restate numbers or say you made a mistake, because there's so much work that goes into public earnings statements. Any figure, any metric, there are teams of people. So the fact that they missed this for a while and had a mistake is never a good thing for any company, and especially not for Twitter, because it is taking over some of the spotlight of what otherwise would have been a great quarter.
And especially since it's for such a basic metric in terms of how many people are using your service.
It also just tarnishes the credibility of Twitter during a pretty important period, because it's competing with Snapchat now on ad dollars. And a lot of that comes down to the user base. So that's just another thing to keep in mind. It's not just about the trust. It's also for its business model and its ad dollars when it's got competitors coming in as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can imagine that Twitter wants to highlight any and all good news that it can in this latest round of reporting, because there has been a lot of negative press about Twitter and Twitter users and fake news on the site. And has that significantly hurt the business in the past couple of years?
it certainly put it in the public for something it probably doesn't want to be in the public for. So around a month ago, Twitter disclosed that there was Russian activity on its social media site that sparked a lot of criticism from lawmakers. And there's been so many questions about fake news and what social media sites like Twitter or Facebook are doing to prevent that type of news from having top display. And in the past couple of weeks, even in the past few days, both companies have said that they are trying to do more. But there's a lot of questions around, you know, how much power these social media companies have in spreading fake news and if they should be doing more to stop it.
Now, if I have this right, though, Twitter has said it's going to identify who's purchased the ads on Twitter. Is that right?
Yes, and that's a really big deal. There have been, you know, rumors swelling around Russia-related advertising. I think we know for sure, you know, that was happening during the U.S. presidential election. So far, Twitter's been fairly limited in what it's disclosed, but we do know that it now will be doing that, which is a pretty big step toward the future.
Well, Emily Glazer is with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
And we're broadcasting this week from Kansas City. One of the first things you notice when you come here is the airport. There are few like it in the country. KCI's three terminals are shaped like horseshoes. They were built more than 40 years ago, and many believe the decades have not been kind.
This airport has done a very good job for 45 years, but it is past its useful life.
Jolie Justice is on the city council. She's also head of the airport committee, which is asking voters to approve an upgrade that would tear down the old horseshoes and replace them with a single billion-dollar terminal.
We have significant infrastructure issues that need to be addressed, but the bottom line is that the configuration is not meeting modern air travel.
It's an unusual airport. We're standing right now in the ticketing area. We're probably, 70 feet from the backside and 10 feet from the front. So people come in, they don't have to go through long hallways to get to their gates. But at the same time, one security checkpoint can only handle a few gates.
That's right. And so with the horseshoe configuration that we have, we're not able to have the traditional TSA checkpoints that you'd have in other airports. And then you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the space. The space in the waiting area next to the gates is only 36 feet wide. And so when you have the planes coming and going, it's incredibly crowded, and it creates a very, I think, congested, uncomfortable departure.
And whereas in most airports there are a lot of restaurants and shops on the other side of security, here that might not be the case, just because there's not room.
Absolutely. Most of our problem here is that the majority of our restaurants and restrooms are outside of security. And so for those of us who like to travel, get through security, and then make sure that we're ready to go, there's not a lot of amenities on the inside.
And Justice pointed out something else that's sort of strange about this airport. There's a thick glass wall that rises about three quarters of the way up to the ceiling. It separates us from the secured gates.
The airport was opened in 1972, and on the front page of the Kansas City Star that day, there was also an article about a hijacking that had taken place on an international flight. And immediately, this airport became out of date from security measures because it was decided immediately by the FAA that we needed to separate our ticketing and our boarding areas. And so we had to then build a wall between the ticketing and boarding areas, which really has created a lot of our problems. So we have kept up with security needs as we've moved forward. We are not right now in compliance with TSA regulations. We're grandfathered in. The TSA would like to see substantial changes here. We're doing the best that we can.
Because somebody could just throw something right over that wall.
Without question, someone could throw something as innocuous as a set of car keys, but they could also throw something more dangerous over. And so this is not an ideal situation from a security standpoint.
I was reading that when this airport was originally built, TWA is the one that wanted it to be like this. And then as soon as that happened, they decided actually they wanted some changes made. Kansas City said no, and then they moved their hub to St. Louis.
And that's one of the concerns that a lot of voters have. They remember that, and they remember that frustration. And so they're worried that the airlines might make those sorts of decisions. But the way that we have this crafted is that the airlines are responsible to backstop all of the debt on this. And so regardless of whether an airline decides to go somewhere else, they are still going to be responsible for paying back the debt on this. And furthermore, we are at a point right now where other cities are more expensive to fly into. We are in the middle of the country, and we have the room to grow, and we really, really, I think we should take advantage of that.
Ahead of the vote next month, people in Kansas City have been following this story very closely, though perhaps not as closely as Steve Vakrot, a reporter with the Kansas City Star who's been watching the airport debate for years. He says businesses in the area, especially those with employees who have to fly a lot for work, are in favor of the new airport.
The public at large, though, has seen, I think, the experience that people have, particularly for infrequent flyers, is that, you know, this airport is easier to use than some of the bigger ones that they may connect through when they fly to one place or another. I mean, compared to, say, like Chicago O'Hare, mm-hmm. or New York's LaGuardia.
They like it. They like this one.
They like it. They feel that it's easier to use, that, you know, the lines and the walks and the trip from the terminal to the parking is not as onerous as you can find in certain airports. And so there's always been this pushback. And I think about 6 years ago, there was sort of this feeling coming out of City Hall, like, you know, we're going to do this. And, you know, some of the people have since acknowledged to me that it might have been a little tone deaf, that they were kind of foisting it upon the public. And that sort of created this division where, you know, City Hall is really pushing for this, but the public is pretty reticent and not necessarily trusting all of the rationales that are being offered for it.
It didn't take long for us to find skeptical flyers. Here's Steve Long.
Well, I mean, I parked, you know, 100 feet from here. We're standing a little bit of a line here, but otherwise, I mean, we just go to ticketing, go to the gate, and go. And then when you leave, it's, you know, the reverse of that.
It's just so convenient, he says. He doesn't live in Kansas City, so he can't vote on this, but if he did,
I'd probably say no, new airport.
Mona Bailey, meanwhile, has a mixed view.
I like this one. I love this one. It's very convenient. But if you've ever been stuck in an airport, there's no place to eat here. I was just through Houston. Oh, man, they've got updates every place. And it was fast and quick, and there was places to eat. So, I mean, I'm just saying, if you get stuck in an airport, you're just stuck out here in this ring. Because even though we Kansas Cityans love it, visitors hate it. They really do.
But fixing a problem this big won't be easy or cheap. Who will pay? Jolie Justice promises that taxpayers will not be on the hook for the billion-dollar price tag. She says the money will come from fees paid by the airlines, parking revenue, and concessions. Steve Vakrot at the Kansas City Star says Justice is right about that.
There's no taxpayer involvement, and that's been something that, you know, I think the pro-KCI boosters have wanted to make very clear, is because there's a lot of confusion out there about, you know, are we as citizens on the hook for this thing? I mean, what if it fails? If it fails, are we on the hook? And the answer is no.
And this isn't just about the money it costs to build the terminal, but about potential lost economic opportunity with an airport that doesn't cater to business travelers. Supporters like Jolie Justice say companies could skip over Kansas City if the airport isn't improved.
We have a huge health IT company here called Cerner, and they're actually the largest user of this airport. They have over 300 flights a day. And we're often fearful that they'll have to look at going somewhere else because they have so many of their associates flying in and out of Kansas City every day. Many of our architectural and engineering firms, I've heard before that we have more architects and engineers in Kansas City per capita than anywhere else in the world. They're constantly flying out to their job sites, and if it takes 2 days to get in and out of Kansas City, they'll start to put satellite offices up elsewhere or just relocate.
Also of concern for business travelers, the airport is called Kansas City International, but at the moment, the only international flights are to Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean.
We are the largest city in the country without a direct transatlantic flight. And so we cannot meet the needs of our corporate citizens and the frequent flyers if we don't get some transatlantic service. And we're working hard to do that, but we can't do it with our current configuration.
Do you think you'll be able to do it if you have a new terminal? You think you'll have a flight to London?
So I've been working on this airport issue for 2 years now, and every day when I get frustrated and think that it's not going to happen, I just picture myself on that first direct flight to London, and I know that it's going to be worthwhile because we're going to have that direct transatlantic service.
My job is to sell airlines on Kansas City, is to convince airlines to grow here. And the airlines have said, we don't like what you're selling.
That's Justin Meyer, the airport's deputy director of aviation. Meyer says he can't take an official position on the ballot measure, but he says one problem with the current airport is connecting flights. Many travelers trying to connect have to exit security and then go back through.
The new terminal means that perhaps we would have a few more connections. And if we get those connections, then the upside is more nonstop flights. Because we've got markets where I'm talking to an airline like Southwest about nonstop flights to Columbus, Ohio, where we've got less than 100 passengers. And they say, look, Justin, my airplane's 143 seats. It doesn't work without having a little bit of connecting flow. So if we had a facility that facilitated connections, similar to the way Southwest has built a connecting bank structure in St. Louis, then the benefit for locals is the additional nonstop flights to existing markets and new nonstop flights to new markets.
Voters in Kansas City will have their say on November 7th in what will likely be the most consequential airport vote here since the 60s, when voters decided they wanted the three horseshoes that exist today.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Social unrest had been brewing for decades in Russia leading up to 1917, when two events swept across the country. First, the February Revolution toppled the 300-year-old Romanov dynasty and a provisional government was formed. Then later in the fall of 1917, Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, seized power from that provisional government. The so-called October Revolution, modern calendars push the date into early November, would eventually lead to the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, and the Cold War before the Soviet Union's dissolution in 1991. Lucian Kim is NPR's Moscow correspondent and joins us now to talk about how this year's anniversary resonates in Russia today. Welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here.
It's good to talk with you. So first of all, just give us a sense about how Russia is observing or acknowledging this 100th anniversary.
Well, it's a tricky thing. There have been some exhibits in museums. In fact, one is opening in the Hermitage, the former Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, which was one of the main sites of the revolution. The Kremlin has said there will be no official commemoration on November 7th. November 7th is, of course, famous for its tank parades on Red Square during the Cold War. Putin likes the tanks, but not the holiday. And so now those parades take place in May to celebrate the victory in World War II. And to keep the older generation happy, November 4th has been now made a holiday, and it's called the Day of National Unity.
Okay, so then tell us more about who is celebrating now.
Well, the Communist Party of Russia says, they say they will celebrate the revolution. They want to celebrate the entire first week of November. They say they're going to invite Communist parties from around the world, and they will visit Lenin's tomb, which is still on Red Square. And I think the fact that it's still there is a symbol of the ambivalence in Russian society toward that event.
Okay, really interesting. So perhaps we should talk about the man who followed Lenin, and that's Joseph Stalin, of course, because that has to be part of the challenge here. I mean, Stalin was responsible for the death of millions. So what's the view of Stalin in Russia today?
The view is very mixed. You can find memorials to Stalin, even new memorials. He's being remembered as the leader who industrialized Russia, and I think most importantly, the man who defeated Hitler in World War II. And a lot less is made about the totalitarian nature of his regime. There was a poll taken earlier this year. 46% of respondents said they had a positive view or assessment of Stalin. And only 21% said they found him negative. I think it's really a reflection that there's not a lot of public discussion about Stalin's repressions today, and he's widely seen as a good manager.
So, Lucian, you mentioned a little bit about how President Vladimir Putin is looking upon this anniversary. Tell us more.
Well, I think the clearest words that Putin said about the revolution itself was last year in a speech. He called for a sober analysis of 1917, of the events of that year, He said it was really important not to allow any splits in society today because of those events, and that it was really time for reconciliation. I think it's important to remember that after the Russian Revolution, you had a really bloody and long civil war before the Soviet Union really established power over the entire territory.
Well, so we're talking today about the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, but of course, Russia itself today is a very, very complex nation. There's another presidential election coming up next March. I mean, what does the near future hold?
Well, Russians are really searching for an ideology or a national idea following the end of communism, because communism really was a very powerful ideology. Today, the Russian Orthodox Church is playing a bigger and bigger role in sort of filling that void. Russians, in general, view revolutions as something negative. And I think it's fair to say that the one thing Russians want in the future is no more revolutions. And I think that's one reason why they support Putin, because he promises continuity and no sudden changes. And that's the reason why everybody expects Putin to run in next year's election and also to win them.
Well, Lucian Kim is NPR's Moscow correspondent. Lucian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson here at KCUR in Kansas City. And before we leave Kansas City, we wanted to say some thank yous to the people who have been helping us all week, especially our friends at KCUR, Chris Pruitt for his engineering help, Donna Vestal, Maria Carter, and Kyle Palmer, and Nico Leone for hosting us. Our stories were produced by Dean Russell and Peter O'Dowd with help from James Trout and Paul Vikas. You can hear all of them at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now.